Thank you. Okay, Ann, would you like to lead us in roll call?
Here.
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 All right, thank you. I don't see any new board members at this time. Would it be appropriate to reference some of the new faces we might see?
Yes, we, at this time, thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been informed that the city select committee has selected Mr. Crone from the Santa Cruz City Council to replace Lowell Hurst from Watsonville City Council. And that's the only change that I recall at this time.
All right. I look forward to his joining us. Okay. So the Budget, Personnel, and Nominating Committee met, and at this time we go through our election of the 2020 Board of Directors Chair and Vice Chair. The recommendation was to continue as we've had it with Director Friend as our Vice Chair, myself as Chair. I don't know if there's any further questions.
And I think that's what the motion was.
Was it? Okay.
I don't pay attention.
I thought you were just teasing him earlier
Maybe
when
I was.
You said
okay.
that.
Sorry about that. Thank you for that correction. So unless there's any other discussion or any public comment on this matter, I'll leave it up to the board.
I'll move that director or that chair and vice chair nomination.
Second.
Okay. Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We'll move right into our public comment period. Any members of the public here to comment on items that may not be on the agenda? Now's your chance. Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to our reports. Our Budget, Personnel, and Nominating Committee met. We have no action to report at this time. We'll move on to the Advisory Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. The Advisory Committee did meet on February 6th of this month. There was an election of the committee and chair and vice chair, and the results are Janet Brennan is the new chair and Jeff Davis is the vice chair. Also, the Advisory Committee received an oral report on winery emissions and the air district rule applicability. You'll be receiving essentially the identical presentation this afternoon.
Cool. Any questions for Rich? Seeing none, we'll move on to comments and referrals from the chair and board members. Anybody like to share anything? I'm proud to say I'm working with Sustainable Seaside on another EV test drive with the district to bring that forward as part of the upcoming sustainability fair and Earth Day celebration, so we'll do that. And there'll be another chamber next year, I think, in April as well. I'll be serving most of the attention to the Sound Chamber. Great opportunity to outreach. Okay, seeing none, we'll move to Rich's report. Rich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'll go quick because I know we have a busy schedule today. Just a few things. In engineering, in January, the district released a notice 30-day comment on the preliminary decision to approve the issuance of a Title V permit, significant modification to the Calpine Corporation for their facility located in King City. This facility is no longer exempt from the acid rain program, which is a federal program, because they no longer supply energy to Pacific Gas and Electric and steam to an industrial host under their previous contract. So the acid rain program requirements have been added to their Title V permit, so that represents a modification. And we're accepting public comments on this preliminary decision until February 21st. On February 12th, we had Acela product orientation meeting to review our test environment and begin the process of customizing software for the database that we're installing. And this is probably timely for today's meeting as well. Just want to let you know that a Monterey County winery has applied for burn permit to conduct a conservation burn of approximately 150 acres of piled vineyard materials. Sonoma Ecology Center will be conducting a training on burning piles on Thursday, February 20th, tomorrow, to demonstrate the methods of conservation burns. And what this does is it greatly decreases smoke emissions from the burn pile, and then you're left with a residue, which is called biochar, which can be used as a soil amendment and it helps grapes grow. We've done this in the past with other wineries, and we've actually worked with a winery to remove some of their windbreaks, and they took down a lot of trees, and we used an air curtain incinerator, so we've been employing new technologies for these types of operations. In planning and air monitoring, our phase two of the Monterey Bay Electric Vehicle Program continues. As of date, we've received about 250 applications, and we've obligated about $210,000 of the $400,000 that was set aside in our budget. So we have $190,000 remaining. So we're processing onward and forward with the incentive program. I should also say that I'll be meeting with Monterey Bay Community Power and a number of citizen activists to discuss future plans for incentive programs, including outreach to low-income and disadvantaged communities and trying to get other dirty vehicles off the road using this incentive program. So that's going to be taking place in the next couple of weeks. Also, I wanted to thank the Monterey County Board of Supervisors for the East Garrison EIR to allow expanded use of the mitigation fund. We'd gotten involved with that about $2.4, $2.5 million when that project was first proposed as a mitigation fund for NOx remediation. And unfortunately, we didn't receive any administrative funds. So as you know, it takes money to give money away. So we also had it earmarked specifically for ag pumps and school buses for change out to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions. We've opened the door now on that to include things such as electrification and infrastructure. So we have a greater universe to apply reductions. We've gotten all the low-hanging fruit, so we needed to open that up and allow an expansion on the eligible projects that could be funded. So we're very grateful for that. We've also received $175,000 in grant funds from the California Air Resources Board for the Wood Stove Changeout Program, and we'll be getting that together quickly. We're working with our LaserFiche, which is our new document management system, and we hope to have an online application in the near future so we don't have to process these things by hand over the phone. So that should be a significant improvement over previous years. With respect to outreach, we'll be at the Salinas Valley Ag Tech Summit at Hartnell College on March 18th. We'll be participating in the Earth Day event at the Presidio in Monterey on April 7th. And then just to save the dates, and then Steve mentioned the other seaside action will be electric vehicle test drives. We'll also be having our Clean Air Leaders Awards on June 11th at 6:30 p.m., and then it will be at the Wedgwood in Carmel Valley again. So you'll be hearing from me each month about that. And this will be our 10th year, so it's a big deal. Then lastly, I just want to let you know, tonight I'll be speaking for the Citizens Climate Lobby, Monterey County, the Center for the Blue Economy, and Monterey Bay Aquarium-sponsored talk on climate crisis in action. And Jimmy Panetta, Congressman Panetta, is headlining that as the keynote speaker. And I'll be specifically talking about the California waiver and what that means to California in terms of climate change and also public health aspects. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions for Richard? Yeah.
Rich, could you say the date again for the Clean Air Awards?
Thank you.
June 11th?
Oh, June 11th.
Right. Thank you.
If I may also, included in your package, you will see a table. And this actually depicts the vacancies on our advisory committee and the need for a hearing board membership. We need a medical professional, two public members on the hearing board. And then the rest of the list speaks for the vacancies available, and each of you are allowed to appoint two members to represent on our advisory committee.
Thank you.
Sorry, so are you saying that the medical professional and public member seats are also vacant?
Yes, we need those. So if you know somebody and you would like to nominate them, please do so.
Great, thank you very much. Any other questions at this time for Rich? Just a quick comment back on the mitigation out of East Garrison. You know, Rich, there's a lot of conversation with the Monterey Bay Community Power about an incentive for electrification of new construction, especially homes. I think I've heard 2,500 per unit and even more for low income units. So something similar, even with remodels, to the EV grant program, there may be some room for collaboration and maybe it's worth bringing up. It's still an interesting, it's still being talked about, but presents a real opportunity to get our name out and make a difference, even for potential new construction.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, what we hope to do at East Garrison is look into the potential of having a neighborhood charging station. That way we don't have to go into the individual houses, and I don't want to make this an agenda item right here, but the idea is a lot of low-income people cannot afford and don't own their homes, so they're not going to be able to upgrade panels and all their associated. So if we can do neighborhood charging stations, I think that gets to the point even, and we'll be working with Monterey Bay Community Power on it.
Great, thanks. So we have our consent agenda. Is there any member of the board at this time that would like to pull an item from the consent agenda? Seeing none, is there a member of the public that would like to pull an item from the consent agenda? Okay, seeing none, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda? Moved and seconded. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. So we move to our regular agenda. Item 14 is an action item, and this is our public hearing and chance to adopt a resolution on approving upgrades to the rural portfolio. That, Amy, are you ready? Oh, Sean will be up. Terrific, Sean, we're ready for you.
Members of the board, my name is Sean King. I'm here to talk to you today about our proposed Route 441 and regards to the boilers, steam generators, and vacuum heaters. Today I'll talk about four key elements in my presentation, which is the background of the rule, the proposed rule requirements, the impact of the rule, and as well as the timeline. Just to give you a background, information on Route 441, the health and safety code requires in air district that is non-attainment for one or more criteria solutions. So that is for us to replace our ozone, to adopt an expedited, best available, electrification schedule. In fact, I don't know if you guys recall, back in October 16, 2018, the board did adopt the expedited schedule on Tuesday today. It is important to note that SPARC is only required to industrial sources that were subject to the state cap and trade program as of January 2017. For our district, that is, we have a total of four sources located in Monterey County. Group 441 only applies to units rated greater than 62 million. During the development of our rule, staff made continuous effort to reach out to the affected industry stakeholders to develop a rule that is reasonable and achievable. Shown below are some of the activities done to show that effort. We had a kickoff meeting in May 2017, had site visits with the affected industry stakeholders, had site visits with printer manufacturers, vendors in October 2019. 2019, as well as a public workshop on last month. For more information on Route 441, you could give a query of our database to find out how many units will be affected by this school. And based upon our database, approximately 40 units in the district would need to be retrofitted. And these units are all located within the four facilities subject to the roof. And these four facilities are known as the WAC, Chevron, ERA, and Eagle Patrol. So what is the purpose of Room 441? Purpose of Room 441 is to control oxides of nitrogen emissions and as well carbon monoxide emissions from boilers, steam generators. This slide just shows you an image of what these equipment look like. On the left, on the phosphorus heater, and on the right, you have a steam generator. And then this slide is just for a geographical overview of where these sources are located. We have one up north in the Salinas area, which is the WAC. Then our three oil and gas facilities all located in San Ardo. And then we have ERA and Eagle Patrol. Before I go into the proposed park emission limits of Route 441, I would like to point out some of the exemptions allowed in this group. The first one is to point out the low fuel usage exemption. So what this means is any low use units that use less than 90,000 grams or 9 billion cubic feet per year are exempt from new park emission limits. Any units that use less than 10% of the maximum while meeting the maximum of 30 ppm and CO limit of 400 ppm are exempt. Any units that were not operational, that did not operate the outcome of the exempt. And any units that operated during emergency events, only up to 100 hours to zero hours. It is important to note that low use and non-operational units become subject to the department if they enter status much in the compliance schedule set forth in the rule of So, the good question. The park emission limits. So, staff designed different park emission limits for boilers and process heaters and oil heaters and steam generators. You can see here on the table, a boiler and process heater with a patient capacity between 2 to 5. Greater than or equal to 20. Nine, any oil-free steam generators greater than or equal to 2, must meet a maximum limit of 15 ppm. These limits were determined by comparing other air district rules to be consistent. And it's also important to note that the state actually did a BART determination back in 1991. In that document in 1991, they determined that a NOx limit of 30 ppm using low NOx burner was achievable. So it's been 28 plus years since that time frame, so that believes that with these proposed emission limits, that it is reasonable, cost effective, and achievable. So kind of give you an overview or an idea of what these emission reductions look like. Currently in our district, these steam generators are allowed to emit 180 to 280 parts per minute. These permit limits are required to do annual source testing or quarterly source testing and to ensure that they need around 50 to 75 parts per minute. What we are proposing is to reduce that to 15 parts per minute. Just to kind of give you a number in terms of tons of emissions, 280 parts per million units emit about 99 if the unit is retrofitted to meet 15 parts per minute, they emit about 5 parts per minute. So we're reducing about 90 tons. Like I said, we did some outreach and everything, and during our outreach and conversation, the industry stakeholders did note that typically these units operate between 50 to 75% of the design capacity. So thus, when we were evaluating our emission reductions from these units, we took account to the comments, and we actually did evaluate the emission reductions based upon 50 to 75% of their operating capacity. So what are the control technologies out there that will help us achieve this NOx limit? The very obvious one is the ultra-low NOx burner. So what is a low NOx burner? It's basically a technology that uses fuel-to-air emission control so that you can get a larger and branch flame, which then helps reduce the also was determined that it was satisfactory. The other technology that was again, also helped achieve NOx reduction is the use of a selective catalytic reduction, also known as SCR. So how does this process work? With a combustion exhaust stream, they inject ammonia into the exhaust stream. That ammonia then reacts over to a catalyst, which then so, what are the costs? So, the items that were taken into account for cost effectiveness were capital costs, operating costs, and maintenance costs. After conducting and taking into account all those costs, that calculated the cost effectiveness to install and also run on stream is within the range of $2,800 to $26,000 per ton of NOx reduced. How do we determine that it is cost effective? Based upon SOX versus air quality management staff cost effectiveness ratio, they determine that anything less than $29,000 per ton of NOx reduced is cost effective. Therefore, our calculation shows that it is all less than $29,000, therefore, it is cost effective. So, after this rule is proposed, what are the compliance facilities? Facility that is subject to Rule 441 must submit a document or letter detailing the method of achieving compliance by the end of this year. Then submit an authority to construct permit application by the end of next year. Then demonstrate full compliance by the end of 2020. So what are the impacts from Rule 441? By implementing the control technology and reduction, we anticipate that we're about to reduce about not emission about 690 to 1,390 tons per year. This type of review is implemented based upon a comment we received when I did my presentation to the advisory committee meeting. The advisory committee members thought that it was important to show the board members the impact of Rule 441 based upon our district NOx emission inventory reduction forecast based on our 2017 air quality management plan published in March of 2017. Based upon our 2020 inventory, we reduced about 31 tons per day from all our sources, and that includes mobile sources, stationary sources, area sources. Of that impact for Rule 441, the emission reduced that we see is about 2 tons per day. And that equates to about 6% of the total reduction from all our sources. So this is just the timeline of the development of our rule. The FAR schedule was adopted in October 2018. We had our public notice, first public notice, notice in November 2019, had our advisory committee meeting in December of 2019, then we did a second public notice in January of 2020, then had our public workshop in January 15 of 2020, and here we are today for board adoption. And if adopted, we anticipate the compliance by the end of December 2022. So in conclusion, based upon the comments that we received, it is our understanding that, based upon the comments we receive from both the public and the industry stakeholders, it is our understanding that we created a rule that is reasonable and achievable, and they do understand that they felt included in the process and that they understand the rule content. Most of the comments that were submitted were addressed. However, I would like to mention one comment regarding source testing frequency. The comment was requested MBAR to change the annual source testing frequency of the steam generators from annual source testing to 5 years with periodic monitoring. After further review, MBAR did not change the source testing frequency to continue to keep the annual source testing frequency in place. There is currently no certified test method for portable analyzer monitoring. Moreover, EPA noted that if a facility is subject to federal oversight, meaning they have a Title V permit, and three of the four facilities in our subdivision do have Title V permits, are subject to meet EPA test measure requirements. Thus, we felt by these findings that we continue to meet the annual requirements. Overall, these units have been in place in decades. They have never been modified, so they were never required to upgrade to meet these lower emission standards. Furthermore, with the exemptions allowed by Rule 441, staff anticipates approximately 12 units that are subject, 12 out of the 40 units that are subject to the rule to be retrofitted. Furthermore, lastly, I would like to say, with the adoption and the implementation of Rule 441, these additional emission reductions will help MBARs continue to meet federal and air quality standards for ozone and come closer to achieving the state 8 hours ozone standard. With that being said, that concludes my presentation. If you have any questions regarding Rule 441.
Okay, thank you for a great presentation. This is a hearing. Members of the board, if you have questions, are there any questions to comment? Okay, seeing none. Members of the public, if that would like to comment on this, if there's anybody here that would like to say anything, yes, okay. So, your name, your entity, and you got about 3 minutes.
I hope to keep very brief, shorter than that. My name is Tom Ferrison. I work for Chevron USA, and my job is in the inheritance compliance and permitting for Santa Ana Oilfield. I also work in the San Joaquin Valley, and we work in St. Joe there. Chevron has 19 active steam generators and 9 inactive ones. By inactive means, they're not currently in operation, but at some point in the future, 19 needs to be developed. We also have 6 heater treaters. Here's one of those. I just bought that heater earlier, you saw with one of ours. These will all be impacted by this new rule. There will be significant costs under this rule for Chevron. Before I go on, I want to say, although the rule is on an expedited basis, we really do appreciate the time staff put in. They listened to most of our comments and responded to the ones that they could and felt they could, and came up with very nice solutions, especially for including provisions for operations with limited use. Talked about that earlier. And also coming up with a schedule that would work within our budgeting and construction process. So now that I've said a couple of good things, I do have to say we were disappointed in one of the things that was mentioned by Song earlier. And that was on the request for flexibility to tax testing using EPA methods. Well, sure, Chevron has historically conducted stack testing at least once a year. The cost of doing such testing has risen considerably since the district discontinued the in-house program. As an alternate to the annual testing, it means we bring a van out, a hire contractor to bring a van out to put something in the stack and measure the emissions. We propose to, as I mentioned, go to a 5-year perhaps or some other period between 1 and 5 years. And in the interim, use portable combustion analyzers. The use of portable combustion analyzers is a little simpler. It's just if you roll a black box, it does the same thing, but it's battery operated and much easier to do on a more frequent basis. You stick in the stack and you get a reading of what the NOx emissions are as well. The use of portable analyzers is allowed by the rule for smaller units, but the district did not choose to use that option for larger steam generators. Not to get into an argument, but the rule is not part of a federal Title V program. This rule is strictly a state program rule under AB 617, and as such, we feel there's considerable flexibility on the frequency of stack testing. Not the test methods when they're done, but how often you have to do that.
If you could just wrap it up.
I will very quickly wrap it up. While we support the adoption of the rule overall, we request that the staff be directed to continue to work with industry on alternate annual stack testing to be included in this rule. Yeah, any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Hello, my name's John Haley, and I'm the Environmental Health and Safety Lead for Harris. And I'm here today representing our San Arno operation. I'd like to thank the board for the opportunity to provide comments. Yeah, I think it'd be remiss to congratulate Chairman Shane on his unanimous reelection. And I could safely say that no business wants more regulations that impact their operations. But when the district started the process of developing Rule 441, we were pleased that most of our equipment was already equipped with the controls necessary to meet the stricter BARC standards. We work hard to meet or exceed the numerous regulations set by the federal, state, and local governments to oversee our operations, and we're committed to applying that same delegation to Rule 441. We would thoroughly like to commend the district staff on their transparent process used in developing this rule and their thorough consideration of our concerns. District staff, in the initial discussion, spent considerable time explaining the background of the 8617 regulation, of what legislation behind the need for this rule, and more importantly, we actively solicited our input and were open-minded in listening to our concerns, especially a lot of these conversations were very technical in nature. So again, we appreciate the district staff's use of a thoughtful and transparent process and their support for the adoption of this rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. We'll bring it back to the board for any further discussion or motion.
I'd move staff recommendation and adoption of the resolution.
Moved and seconded. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Good. Motion carried. Thank you. So the next item is not an action item, but it's a report.
Yeah. This is our annual report to you on some of our activities from the previous calendar year. And this replaces in the past, we used to do every month, we give you activity data, but it kind of seemed a little out of context, and so we decided we'll just give you an annual report every year so you can see what we're up to in 2019. So I'm going to talk to you about engineering compliance. I'll give you a brief background on what both of those departments do, and then I'll give you some information about what we did last year. So on the engineering side, we take in the permit applications, we review the equipment that people are requesting a permit for, we issue the permit. They develop rules and regulations, as you saw Song just a moment ago, and then we also do an annual stationary source and mission inventory. So in 2019, we have had continued activity. We've gotten hundreds of permit applications, issued 171 authority to construct. And so our permit process is a two-step process. A person applies for a permit, and they get something called an authority to construct. And then they go out and they install their equipment. Our engineer goes out and double checks that everything matches the application, and then they come back to the office and we'll issue the permit to operate. And so that's what those startup inspections are. That's the activity in between the authority to construct and the permit to operate. And then we register agricultural diesel engines. So these are engines that are used typically for irrigation. We register those types of engines. And then we did issue two Title V permits last year. So that's similar to what Song was talking about. Some of our larger sources have these federal operating permits that renew every 5 years or have to be changed up if there's a change in their operation. And then we did issue two emission reduction credits. And so that's if the business closes and they can apply to take their emissions that they had and put them into a bank. We had two of those last year. So I just wanted to just give you an idea. So the pictures show the yellow vessels are siloxane treatment. And siloxane is from man-made compounds, deodorants, cosmetics, hair products. And so those can get into landfills and wastewater treatment. And so when that happens, they're going to use that gas in, this is the picture is a dual fuel boiler. They're going to take that gas and run it in a boiler, in an engine. They need to clean it up first. And so just a little project that we had last year, installation of a siloxane treatment system, and then allowed operation using that digester gas fuel in that boiler without corroding it. Siloxane can damage the engine or the turbines, so they want to clean that out. As continues to be the trend, emergency engines are our number one volume of permitted units in the three counties, followed by gas stations, paint spray, boilers, and crane engines. So we have several big categories. So once a permit's issued, it goes over to our compliance staff, and our inspectors go out and make sure everyone's following their permit conditions. If they find a business operating and not following their permit conditions, then in some cases they'll issue a violation. And you'll see in your monthly mutual settlement reports when they get their violations and the penalties they sometimes have to pay. We also have a delegation for the federal asbestos regulation. And so we're expecting actually this year to see an uptick in projects out at the former Fort Ord. The Fort Ord's Reuse Authority is sunsetting in June, and so we're seeing a lot of activity to try to get as many buildings knocked down as they can. So we're expecting to see lots of activity this year in that area. And then our inspectors also respond to complaints that we receive from the public. So last year was a busy year also on the compliance side. We had over 1,600 inspections, issued 232 notices to comply. And a notice to comply is more of a warning from the inspector. I found you operating, you're not following this permit condition. I'm going to give you a warning. You know, please make a correction and follow your permit. We issued 59 notices of violation, and that's when the person gets a penalty for a violation. We had 151 asbestos inspections, 285 complaints, 19 breakdowns. And breakdowns is when something goes wrong on a piece of equipment, a sensor or something, and so they'll call in and say, this broke down, I can't meet my permit condition, and so they'll report those to us. We observed 39 source tests and issued one variance. So this is just kind of our multi-year activity. The top line shows pretty a trend that we've had a pretty stable, about 3,000 permits since 2013. The next bar down, the blue dashed line, is the number of inspections. And we had a dip in 2017. We had some staff turnover that year with retirement. But you can see it's kind of picked back up in 2018 and 19, so we're getting back on track there. And then the last three bars at the bottom are just showing complaints, permit applications, and permit issued. So we're kind of in a maintenance mode now, but it's, you know, we have a workload that we need to maintain with the staff that we have. So we have plenty of work to do. So if there's any questions?
Questions from board members? I have a question for you. The emissions reduction credit, the bank, how's our bank balance? You know, what sort of efforts are underway to try to address that for those that are not in the community to utilize the bank?
So we do have a pretty low balance on our bank. We did have... we will reach out to sources if they cancel a bunch of permits. We'll reach out and say, are you aware that you could, you know, you've closed your business, you could bank those emissions? Because we are aware that we do have a small bank. So if the time comes, we try to reach out to sources to tell them that this is an option available to them. And I guess there is the possibility that you could, our rule would allow you to get credits from another air district. I just don't know that the other air district, it really depends on the person who owns those credits in the bank and whether or not they're willing to surrender those credits to somebody else. And typically they don't want to do that.
Yeah,
they don't want to leave their jurisdiction.
And I would just add that typically if it does leave the jurisdiction, it's at a discounted rate. So it could be 1.5 less or thereabouts. So it's not usually cost effective. You're purchasing for twice the amount you would.
What are they going for? Is that if you're asking for the credit
I'd say $3,000 to $10,000 a ton.
Santa Barbara, however, for VOCs, they were close to $1 million a ton.
All right. Any questions from members of the public on this report or comments? This is not an action item. So thank you very much, Amy. We'll move on to our next report that comes from Rich.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will be giving the presentation because David Frisby is out on medical leave. He'll be back in about 3 weeks. So we wish him a speedy recovery. And I've also got Bill Chevalier here. If you have any questions, I can't answer, but I'll take you through it. So this is basically like the presentation Amy just gave. This is the annual report we're giving for monitoring. So this slide depicts the monitoring sites located throughout our jurisdiction. The black portion, for instance, shows ozone. These are typically what were called SLAM, state local air monitoring sites. There are special purpose monitors that you'll see up in the left-hand corner. Those are associated with our wood stove program that we primarily monitor during the winter months. This is a typical look at our monitoring stations, the one on the left's Carmel Valley. We really have to take a lot of precaution with siting these. We actually cut down a tree near one of these, and that other tree is growing a little close to this monitoring station. We try not to have any interference. The one on the right is the Salinas monitoring station. I believe that's by the airport, Bill? Yes, okay. So no. this shows you the instrument rack inside the buildings and the spaghetti that's wired to it. We've got a lot of delivery tubes for the gases as well as the sampling ports. And then you see that one's a particle sampler there on the right. So this is our ambient air quality standards. This is basically 1 hour to 24 hour standards. Ozone, you'll see that there's two standards, 1 hour and the 8 hour. The 1 hour standard's never really been an issue for us. The 8 hour standard is a concern, and you'll see that California and the national standards are the same for the standard for ozone, but how they get there is completely different. So even though they're the same, they have different calculations. The good news is we've met the national standard requirements. The bad news, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, is that we're sort of teetering on the California standard, and we're in a what's called transitional non-attainment. There is no California standard for PM2.5, but we do have one for PM10, and once again, that's at 24-hour averaging sample. We typically don't get into the national standards or the secondary standards there for the PM2.5 or the PM10. So this is a really a scratchy graph here showing the ozone 8-hour peak concentrations. We're getting close to them, as you can see up in San Benito County. We've always been flirting. Every year, the American Lung Association gives San Benito County a failing grade because of that. They've actually done better in the past few years, but Santa Cruz County as well, we're pretty well under that. And then Monterey County, you can see we're also floating, but we're not going over it, so that's the good news there. This shows you our concentrations of PM2.5. That's the respirable or inhalable fraction of dust and smoke. And so, you know, the hands don't have to go up. What's going on with that red spike on the lower graph? And basically what happened there is there was a short or a small fire next to the monitoring station, and it picked it up, and it did it in a really good way. So we know it works pretty well. So that was put out, and that will not count against us as an exceedance. So that's the good news there. PM10 concentrations, this is the recurring problem that this district has. We just have a lot of problems in primarily King City with PM10, and this is primarily dust from agricultural operations. And whenever we get a wind event, if we were to show you wind speed, it would probably clock pretty close to this graph as well. So when the winds get high, it just picks up the dust, and it all goes to our monitoring site. And so you can see we're well above. We're usually teetering on the edge, but we've gone well above. And I think one of the reasons that we haven't exceeded earlier in the year is because we had a really good rainy year last year, and that kept things very wet and moist. So that's a good control strategy. In fact, that's the only control strategy that I'm aware of for keeping dust down, is to apply water. So obviously we can't order rain up as we'd like to. So we did see some spikes there, and we're going to be working with the agricultural commissioner and other ag interests to see what we can do to bring this down. There was a Senate Bill 565 a number of years ago that required a plan to bring down dust concentrations. We put together a plan, and really nothing happened as a result. And that plan expired, and there was no further action. So this is something that the advisory committee keeps on asking me, when are you going to do something about this? So we have to get into the attainment of the state standard here. The attainment status, so that's the non-attainment transitional I talked about. So basically what we have to do is go an entire year without any violations, and that helps count towards our progress of attaining the standard. Once we do that, there's somewhat of a waiting period. But this is, we're in a holding pattern right now, and they just say we're transitional but non-attainment. We'll see what the date is for this year. So hopefully someday that'll be non-attainment, unless we get a huge spike of, you know, additional sources or something like that. But the trend for VOCs primarily has been downward trend, and that's associated a lot with motor vehicles. And about 60% of our attainment issue, as we've modeled it, is due to other jurisdictions such as the Bay Area and San Joaquin Valley. So until they start addressing their issues there, it's not going to really improve a lot for us, but we're teetering on the brink of attainment. You can see we're primarily in attainment for all the other pollutants there, and we don't have the state, do we have that up? Non-attainment for inhalable, that's PM10, so that's our second line. So that's a big one we have to deal with. So that concludes that presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions or Bill.
Thank you, Rich. Any questions for Rich? Any presentation?
No, I don't know what it is. Could you go back to the, yeah. Could you explain what unclassified means under carbon monoxide in two of the counties in our area?
The way to think of it is that it's just not a problem. And this is primarily due to the automobile emissions. Usually back in the 70s and into the 80s, just about every intersection in the United States had carbon monoxide problems, and a lot of monitors were picking that up. But since the advent of control technologies on automobiles and mobile sources, carbon monoxide is not a really big issue for most states and counties throughout the country, with the exception of Alaska. They've got a lot of diesel generation during the winter months. They have a lot of inversions. So CO is still a pollutant of concern, but it's not an issue here. And we don't even get on the, registered any kinds of marks on the scale for that.
And so Monterey County is in attainment. Why isn't Monterey County also considered unclassified?
Bill? So initially the monitors were deployed in areas that had traffic issues, and so I would imagine this goes way back that we didn't need to put those up in San Benito or Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. And then the ozone, we're getting towards attainment. The state. Standard is harder to meet than the federal, and that was that a fairly recent change that the state dialed that back? I know there was some discussion about there was going to be a change and I don't remember if it was the state or the federal level, and was it ozone? There was something that was going to get stricter.
So yes, it was the feds. The feds were going to go with a more stringent standard for ozone, but that has since been dropped. We probably will see a potential relaxing of the standard with the new administration on ozone. So that is a potentiality, but that would not have any bearing on California's right, calculation
state,
for payment.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that's like Russian language or something. That's cool.
Still missing about half the town in South Washington, and I'm wondering, is there any plans to put another station down?
So this is the $64 million question. A lot of districts are very loath to put one in because sometimes you're not sure what you're going to find. Citing a monitor has to be representative of that area. So we'd have to be sure there's not like a road source or something like that. And based on the profile of the South County, it looks like that one monitor in King City actually represents. We get a good wind flow through that direction. So we're not looking at local neighborhood analysis. We're looking at regional. So some would argue that we maybe have too many monitors, but once one's established, they're very difficult to take away. So that's why you've got to be careful with citing those additional monitors. In fact, we were tracking exceedances with our seasonal monitors up in the Santa Cruz area, and if they'd shown 3 years of exceedances of the federal standard, those would have to become permanent. Right now, they're just special purposes monitors that we deploy on a seasonal basis. And the first year, we had 43 violations of the federal standard. Second year was 11. And then because probably very, very dynamic wind and storm conditions over the winter, we have not been seeing any kind of violations, or we've only seen a handful near violations up in that area, and that's for PM2.5. So, yeah, don't look at the map and assume it's a little different mindset. There's purple air monitors now, which are personal monitoring devices that people can register at their house. If you look at their map, they would show coverages of where people live. But that's a totally different thing. This is a regulatory purpose of monitor. We don't have a lot of population in the South County, so there's not a real lot of reasons to have monitors down there, according to the state and federal Clean Air Act.
Any other questions from the board regarding the report? Members of the public, any questions, comments? Okay, coming back, there's no action on this at this time. So we'll move on to our next report. And that's the moment that some of our guests have been waiting for before we pop the cork.
Okay, well, I'm going to have Mary Gerardo, our Supervisor of Engineering, give this presentation. And I'd just like to start with some comments that we have been talking to the wineries. We've been talking to a number of people, and I will point you to an article that just appeared recently in the Monterey County Weekly. And it's a very complicated issue, as I think anybody in this room will attest. But I think they did a very balanced and fair presentation of what's happening with the request that we still have to receive a formal request, but our informal request to change our rules to accommodate relaxing our standards to allow for growth in the wine industry. So as we promised in the past, this is sort of a comprehensive view of wineries and what's going on. I know we have some representatives of wineries here, and we have some representatives of control technologies here that probably would like to speak as well. So without further ado, I'll let Mary get through it, and I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Gerardo. And as Richard has mentioned, there are concerns within the vintner community that our new source review rule is hindering expansion of fermentation operations within our air district. And as you requested, we have prepared a presentation on winery emissions and air district rule applicability, and have outlined a possible path forward to address these concerns. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about wineries in our district, their emission control, our Rule 201, which is our permit exemption tool, and our resources rule. And then I'm also discuss the state's SB 288 process, which is the rule revision process. And lastly, discuss the impact of a rule revision on our sources. According to the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, there are 192 wine producers and blenders in our jurisdiction, 110 in Monterey County, 68 in San Jose, and 15 in San Benito County. Now, this is the best data I have. It includes blenders, so it's more than just the fermentation operators. But when you look at Monterey County's number, I think there's 82 bonded wineries, so this is 75% of these numbers are really fermentation operations. So, but using the data I have, the best data I have, 180 of these facilities are exempt from permit requirements. And that's 94% of those operations. We do have 11 wineries under local permits, and we are working with two additional wineries, and we are in the application phase with that. One of the 11 permitted wineries also is subject to a federal Title V permit, and that's because they exceed the federal major source threshold of 100 tons per year of volatile organic compounds. As we've already seen in the prior presentation, we are in attainment with all of the federal ambient air quality standards, but we are not in attainment with the state ozone and the PM10 standards. And as you may recall, volatile organic compounds are precursors to both ozone and PM10. So there are several operations at wineries that require permits from us. There's boilers, there's diesel engine fire pumps, emergency generator sets, wastewater operations. But those operations you can find at a lot of different permitted facilities in our district. What's unique to the wineries is their fermentation and their oak barrel aging storage operations. During the fermentation process, carbon dioxide and ethanol are produced. During the oak barrel aging and storage, ethanol is evaporated through the pores of the oak barrel. And that's referred to as the angel share from the industry. Now, the oak barrel aging and storage operations occur throughout the whole entire year. But the fermentation emissions occur only during the peak ozone season, which is typically late summer, early fall. Ethanol is a VOC, and therefore it too is an ozone and PM10 precursor. I've included a table of our 11 permitted wineries, and you can see that 10 of the 11 are in South Monterey County. There is one in San Benito County. And in the third column, I included the average daily VOC emissions just from fermentation operations. And from our 9 largest sources, that varies from 95 pounds today all the way up to 1,800 pounds today. The fourth column lists what each winery is allowed to ferment on their permit and is listed as a condition. For example, Constellation is allowed to ferment 30 million gallons per year. And just for comparison, I also included the aging and storage daily VOC emissions. They are smaller compared to the fermentation emissions, but remember, they occur throughout the whole entire year, not just during that 90-day period. So the dailies are less, but they're not insignificant. I've also included our 2018 emissions inventory for stationary sources that emit greater than 10 tons of any criteria pollutant. These are the sources that have to report to the California Air Resources Board each year. There were 20 sources that had to report, and I highlighted the 5 facilities that are wineries. If you added up all the VOC emissions from our greater than 10-ton sources, it equates to 315 tons of VOCs. And if you add up just from the wineries alone, it's 158. So doing the math, there's 50% of the VOC emissions are from the wineries when we look at our greater than 10-ton sources. give you a perspective on the side. This is Constellation in Gonzales, and Franciscan and the Wine Group in Soledad. And I included these for you, you know, get a feeling of the size and realize they're not small boutique wineries. I'm going to transition now to our local rules 201 and 207. Rule 201 dictates which wineries require permits to operate by establishing permit exemptions. Those facilities that are subject to permits are then subject to Rule 207, which establishes permit thresholds for emission controls and offsets. So a winery can be exempt by one or two ways. If the winery was in operation prior to 1997 and its annual production throughput was less than 1.25 million gallons, it could be exempt. If it's new, or if that existing winery went through reconstruction and its annual production rate is less than 150,000 gallons, it also can be exempt. For a comparison, I also included the exemption thresholds of our neighboring air district. And what you're quickly going to see is that there is a wide range of different thresholds. Santa Barbara County, they look at fermentation, aging, bottling, and if the facility's total emissions are less than 1 ton per year, they're exempt. So converting that to how we look at it, just saying all they do is fermentation, that's equivalent to 320,000 gallons a year of red wine. San Joaquin exempts fermentation if the production rate is less than 47,600 gallons a year. San Luis Obispo does not have an exemption, but by policy, they register their wineries, and they are required to pay annual renewal fees. The area doesn't permit any fermentation, but in 2017, they did commit to conducting a study to determine if emissions generated by fermentation, if they could come up with some reductions. So Rule 207 is referred to as our NSR rule, and it's the heart of today's discussion. This rule establishes federal state emission thresholds for permit review of best available control technology and offsets. And you can think of an offset as an emissions decrease necessary to mitigate an emissions increase from a proposed project in a non-attainment area. So in 1976, the federal batch and offset thresholds were set at 150 pounds per day. So if the facility-wide emissions were equal to or exceeded that value, batch and offsets were required. In 1992, the state mandated it through the Health and Safety Code that batch was required if the individual permit unit, fermentation, exceeded greater than 25 pounds per day. The Health and Safety Code also mandated that offsets were required if the emissions were greater than 25 tons per year. As you can see, the units in the federal NSR were in pounds per day. So in 1993, when we revised our NSR rule, we converted tons per year to pounds per day. I showed the equation because I want to show that they are equivalent when you divide by 365 days. Okay. So there is merit to using a pound per day because that is what the ambient air quality standards are based upon. The 1 hour, 8 hour, 24 hour standards. But for a seasonal source like fermentation, the pound per day unit is more restrictive than a ton per year because they're only operating 90 days out of the year. In 2003, the state then passed the Senate Bill 288, which prohibits air districts from revising their new source review rules to be less stringent than what they were in 2002. And going back from 137 pounds per day to 25 tons per year would be considered backsliding and a rule relaxation. Unfortunately, in SB 288, they did allow for a rule relaxation process, and it requires that the district board make four findings. Those findings included that the revision did not impair or impede continued maintenance with the national standards, or impede or impair progress toward achieving attainment with the state and the air quality standards. The revised rules cannot exempt or relax the requirement to meet best available control technology, and the revisions must be consistent with the air resources, procedural, and environmental justice guidance. I do want to mention that in 2006, we did go through this rule relaxation process, and we were successful in adding an offset exemption, and that's listed in the fourth column, so less than 10 tons per year. What that means is that a facility can exceed 137 pounds per day. They can exceed 150 pounds per day, but as long as their actual emissions are less than 10 tons per year. And they would have to accept that as a condition of their permit. So if we were directed to modify our threshold to 25 tons per year, the next steps would be for the staff to propose revisions to Rule 207. The district board would then need to adopt the required findings. And then lastly, the CARB executive officer would need to appoint a hearing officer to conduct a public hearing here in Monterey to review the rule revisions and the board findings. I really want to emphasize that, again, we can only change the offset threshold. The revision would not alleviate the need for the wineries to install best available control technology. There are two systems that have been achieved in practice and cost-effective in Santa Barbara County. And I'm pleased to announce that those two manufacturers are here today, and they're going to give a presentation on their design. But I do want to state that these emission controls would allow the industry to grow because they would be able to create their own internal offsets. I'm going to circle back now to our list of our 11 permitted wineries and focus on which facilities would see a benefit from the rule revision. If you look at the top three wineries, Constellation, The Wine Group, and Franciscan Vineyards, they're already well over 25 tons per year. So they would see no benefit to a rule revision. Our two smaller sources, Conundrum and KVL, have not yet reached the 10-ton or the 137 pounds per day threshold. So they might see a benefit somewhere down the road, but at this point, they don't need it. It's the six facilities in the center that would see, to different degrees, a relief from offset. So if we look at Del Prado and San Benito, they're already at 23 tons per year. So they would be able to expand an additional 2 tons before offsets were required. J. Lohr is roughly at 12 tons, so they would be able to emit an additional 13 tons per year before offsets were triggered. I do want to focus again on the fifth column, that's the feedback threshold. Again, our nine largest wineries already trigger the 25 pounds per day back threshold. And then I want to focus on the last two columns. Based upon the 2018 fermentation throughputs that they report to us each year, there was only one winery that was within a 500,000 gallons of what they are allowed to do on their permit. So summarizing what was in that last table, a rule change would allow six wineries to increase the overall VOC emissions by 43 tons per year. Converting that into gallons of fermentation, red wine has a higher emission factor than white wine. So it's roughly equivalent to 14 million gallons of red wine or 35 million gallons of white wine. And if I just assume 50% red, 50% white, that would represent a 31% increase in production rates from our permitted wineries. And then lastly, our district
also foresees a rule change would provide additional growth for the emerging cannabis and the composting industries who are also looking for BHC offsets. Hope that was informative. Are there any questions?
All right. Thank you very much, Mary. I'm sure we've got a few. So, directors?
So, quick question. In terms of the ozone, we have the monitoring station in King City. So, is that where we're going over?
So, thank you for that question. So, no, that's not where we're going over. We're going over in the Pinnacles. So typically we see photoconversion of either NOx or VOCs when it's increased in altitude up in the mountains and exposed to sunlight. And we see higher temperatures in the mountains and also higher elevations, which help. So we'd have to do, I'm going to throw out a number of at least $500,000 modeling study to determine what these emissions from increases in various component sectors within our jurisdiction would do to those monitors. It's not an easy one that's downstream. There's a lot of complex photochemistry that occurs. So you're looking at both VOCs and NOx are converted to ozone and then eventually picked up at our monitors. So we can't tell unless we did a really complete comprehensive photochemical study, which is a huge undertaking, usually done by the state, by the way. We don't have the computing power to do that here. But we feel that, and I don't want to steal Mary's thunder, but we feel that with what's proposed that we could probably most certainly accommodate any expansion in those sectors without exceeding the ozone.
I guess that question comes from the idea that, well, August, September, October, the fine harvest and fermentation months in the San Luis Valley. And having grown up there, I know during those months you lean a little harder in one direction because the wind blows so hard. So it's just, to me, that idea of trying to create that, obviously that's different to trying to figure out where it's coming from. That's important because where I come from, the trees grow sideways. But we have a lot of wind, and that's what we know. And so having these questions about where we're going over and calling up those on numbers, but not knowing where it's coming from, does that make sense?
It does make sense, and that's something we've grappled with. But I will tell you this, that when we develop our air quality attainment plans, usually there's measures that all possible measures are required. When you're in non-attainment for ozone, they want us to go after even to the local household level to get people's boilers or their air conditioner or water heaters. And then also surface coating, we've adopted rules for paint manufacturer because there's VOCs there as well. So we've pretty much gotten all the low-hanging fruit with respect to how we can control VOCs. But I think that we've taken a back-of-the-envelope look at this, and we don't feel that increasing this, and of course we'd have to make that finding, but we don't have, this is already costing us a lot of money we don't have, to be honest. We don't have $500,000 to throw at this to do a monolith project. I don't think the state is going to be interested. They're going to look to us to make that determination. So you're right. A lot of that ozone probably goes to the San Luis Obispo, so they're going to have to deal with that as well. But, you know, I can't say for certainty that it won't have any impact, but we sort of think that based on the levels we've already seeing that are over the limits that it's probably not going to have a profound impact.
So then the 13 wineries that we're talking about here, do we know what percentage, what the delta is in terms of how much of the wine that's created in Monterey County is created by these 13 facilities?
Compared to the entire state?
No, to the rest of Monterey County. So we talk about 90% of the industry in these 13 in terms of wine production? Or are we talking 80%?
So we don't have an inventory of all the wineries that are exempt. Because that would be something we would need to go out to gather that information.
Right, that's part of the issue of not permitting a winery. If we do not permit them, we do not visit them, we do not get their records, so we really don't know. We do know that they are below the 1.25 million cap as far as production for the most part. But that's a good question. I mean, and maybe I know Kim Stemmler's here. She may be able to answer that question. What do they represent total volume of compared to the top 13, but as you see, Constellation is a huge winery compared to even the rest of the 12, so we just don't know.
Okay.
sure there's more questions. I knew we had some guests here.
Yes, we do.
Can we keep going with the director events for the presentation, then come back when we have the second presentation? Okay. Any other questions?
I had a question. Yeah, so I'm trying to understand sort of if-then. So right now, if there is the daily pounds limit, if people are at that or above it, is there then the requirement that they use the best available technology to then bring the daily amount? So what's the...
So I didn't get into the details, but so the federal government looked at anything that was installed after 1976.
Mm-hmm.
The state law looks at anything installed after 1993. So there's a lot of facilities that have historical emissions. We had Chevron and Aera and Wasp. You know, they've been here since the 50s, and so a lot of their emissions are not aggregated at this point towards that value. So it would just be if a facility proposes something new, they're already at that level, so that's going to bump them. So that particular project goes through the NSR review. We don't look at the rest of the operations. They're grandfathered in. So we look at the project in front of us. So let's say... an example, the winery has boilers and they have a series of 20 fermentation tanks and they want to install one more fermentation tank. They're over. We would say you need to install back on that new tank and you need to provide offsets for the increase above what you're proposing. So let's say they're at 20 tons already and they want to go up to 21 tons. They would have to offset that one ton. So they don't have to come down all the way. It's what that proposed project is going to be. You look at the project in front of you. You don't go backwards.
So another way to think of it is just they're grandfathered. So with those values you've seen, we're not asking for them to achieve back right now with those values that are even over the limits.
Right.
But if they were to do a major modification as defined by a rule, they would have to make up for those increases in emissions over and above what they currently are emitting.
Okay, so the problem or dispute that, or the concern of the wine industry isn't really about the current operations. It's imagining that in the future something is going to happen where they're going to have to do something to offset the new
I think that's true, and also from what I've heard from the wine industry, and I don't want to I'll paraphrase, my understanding is that any new winery that wants to come in that has over these emission limits would have to comply with VAC standards. So there are those mm-hmm. controls now that we would be looking at. So that would be, I guess you could say, a disincentive relative to some districts but not others. I think the comparison chart about the exemption threshold is very interesting. Santa Barbara has a smaller, some more stringent exemption threshold, so they would mm-hmm. capture those facilities where we would not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Olivia, yeah. How do you turn this on? Is it on?
It's just
you're on.
Yeah.
The biggest concern I hear from the wineries is placing us at an unfair advantage compared to other counties. And you mentioned Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, but we know a lot of our grapes, and we're all trying to get more of our grapes processed here, and then, but a lot of our grapes are trucked up to Napa, Sonoma, Santa Rosa. Where do we compare with them on
So Napa is the Bay Area, and the Bay Area does not permit fermentation at all. However, in 2017, they committed to doing a study, so it looks like they probably will start permitting fermentation.
So, and if I may add, I've had personal conversations with the APCO. I know they just had a meeting with the Wine Institute. And they have informed the Wine Institute that they're going to start the rulemaking process to permit wineries. And so The Napa area is more similar to some of the boutique wineries we have down here that are not permitted. The problem comes in is the Bay Area also has places like Livermore where there's Venti Winery, and they totally dwarf Constellation. They're huge animals. So as I've said in the past, right now they've had refineries blowing up about every month there. This has not been very low-hanging fruit for them. But as a result of the wine industry bringing this to light and asking for forgiveness on regulation, they have looked into it and found that the wineries are indeed a major source of VOC emissions, and they are barking down the rulemaking process. And they fully expect to do a permitting. And now that Santa Barbara has demonstrated that there is back to control requirements available, they expect those are going to be used in Napa and in Livermore and other counties up there.
So right now, Winty, my daughter lives up there and belongs to it, they're not controlled at all?
No.
And their grapes come from a rare sample.
Yeah.
Maybe there's further questions at this time on board members?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll hear from the public. Do you join the public and continue with that presentation? Yeah, okay.
Okay,
so
one
of the then we'll go to the public.
So I shoot pulls the slides off. I'm Patrick Thompson with Aromatica. We're one of the control technologies out there. So our process basically captures vapors released during fermentation. Exactly what we talked about earlier, water, ethanol, and in our case, or in every case, also highly aromatic volatiles, other things. Very trace amounts, but very valuable to the wine industry. The actual technology that we use is condensers. So these are chilled condensers that convert the vapors into what we call wine spirits, or aromatica, that can be used to make better wine, actually help the winery's bottom line, and of course expand sustainability. So the use of chilled condensers as air quality controls isn't new. They've been in EPA manuals since the 70s. For example, in 1982, the Fresno County APCD identified condensation as a cost-effective technology for winery emissions. So condensers aren't new. Our development work has been around making them specifically work for wineries, right? So maximizing capture efficiency while not impacting the winemaker's art. Also lowering costs, demonstrating byproduct value, and then trying to make it easy for the cellar crews to use. As you might guess, with a lot of control technology, the hard part isn't always the technology, it's actually making it easy for the customer to adopt and to have it work with operating procedures. So a couple pictures. The picture on the left there is a large condenser. The black insulated parts are the actual condenser. That's connected by manifolding to 24 tanks. So it's essentially 200,000 gallons of capacity going to a single condenser. The one on the right is an example of a single tank condenser, right? So that would be just coming directly off the top of one tank, capturing the byproduct there. And we also, of course, have done systems both indoors and outdoors, right? So it is similar, really no difference, sometimes a little bit of different insulation and other things like that. But the basic idea of directing the vapors from the top of a fermentation vessel into a condenser and then collecting the condensate is the same at any of these facilities in any size. So the advantages of our technology, as I said before, designed specifically for wineries. The condensers, have a little bit of secret sauce to try to achieve high capture efficiency without putting any back pressure into the headspace, right? So that's really the magic. You can't. A lot of industrial processes and refineries that use chilled condensers to capture rely on a fairly large pressure drop across the condenser. Not to go down in the technical details, but the that doesn't work well in a wine tank. You want to pressurize the wine tank. We use zero water. We have no waste stream. So this is interesting. But it's essentially a aromatic wine spirit that comes right out of the process. So we have sold that stuff to people as much as a dime a milliliter, right? So that's hundreds of dollars a gallon to make better wine, right? To improve wine's aroma profiles and things like that. Very low energy use. We're using house glycol usually. By the way, that is essentially grappa or vodka strength. Yeah. It's just a clean little grape spirit. Low energy use, like I said, we use house glycol, house refrigerant that's already in the wineries for the tanks. Self-cleaning systems. So the carrier gas, of course, is CO2, and the largest constituent is ethanol vapor. So what you really have is something similar to what would be used to clean piping, right? It's a solvent. So the design features that we put in, check valves and foam screens and things like that, make it such that no nutrient is ever going to get in the piping, and what you're pumping through it is essentially a solvent. So it's a self-cleaning system. As was mentioned before, it is designated as achieved in practice backed. And the costs are actually pretty low. So using the cost effectiveness analysis that Santa Barbara did, that equates to less than a penny per bottle, right? Or less than about 6 to 7 cents per case of production. So, you know, just as a point of reference, corks, of course, are 10 to 20 cents per bottle. Labels are 10 to 50 cents per bottle. Bottles are 50 cents to a dollar. So the less than a penny per bottle relative to other inputs to production is relatively cost effective. And I think that's it. I had a couple supplemental slides, but I just wanted to give a quick overview of what we did and how we did it. So, any questions there? Or?
Questions at this time?
So you're saying about a penny per bottle. Is that assuming some minimum number of bottles, or does it?
Sure. So in the cost effectiveness analysis that was done by staff at Santa Barbara, which is just a good publicly available one, mm-hmm. of course it assumes an emissions factor, just like you did, that says here's our emissions factor for X million gallons. And when you have a certain million gallons, you know how many gallons per case. Therefore, you can go backwards and figure out.
Yeah, I just wanted to address Judge Phillips' comment. We currently do not require any controls on any of our wine operations. The only thing that brought this to light was Santa Barbara demonstrated, and it's now in the back clearinghouse for the state, that this technology is available and useful to the industry. So what we're saying is if these guys are going to propose additional expansions, they're going to have to do what they're supposed to do anyway. So it's not that. And then furthermore, if they have an open top fermentation tank, which a lot of red wines are done in, there is no cost effective control technology that can be employed at this point that we're aware of. So they would not have to comply with any kind of emissions control. So it's not this draconian thing. It's just that we had a sister agency that employed the control technology, and now they've shown it to be cost effective. I imagine that eventually everybody will be doing this.
I wish we could be a little more objective about the presentation, though, frankly.
Okay. Okay. Well, we'll keep it still. Was there anybody else, Patrick? Maybe another?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So, why don't we start speaking?
Good afternoon, everyone at the board, and I get to be the guy that stands between you and popping the cork. So as this comes up. Thank you very much for taking the time today to listen to us. And I'm Dan Bellobo with Nobel Corporation, and we're the inventors of Nomovo. So here I just drive I'm going to take a little bit different tact than my friends on presenting what I see as regulation driving innovation. And I'm going to describe a little bit of history up front as to why I think that, and then I'm going to go through how I think and how I see things being configured and implemented into the winery so people understand how these things work. So first thing I wanted to do is a shout out to the wine industry. Here's some statements. You guys can read this. These are their sustainability statements. All very good, all looking out for the industry and for what's going on and trying to do the right thing, continue to do the right thing. And they do. They're building LEED certified buildings. They're going for sustainable growing. They're putting in solar panels to combat and reduce electricity costs. They're going with ISO standards, they're very complex things. So they're doing really good things. So I want to give a little bit of a history lesson about me and where I come from and why my perspective, some of my perspective on it. In my initial career, my first 17 years out of school, these are three companies that I worked for. And I was the guy in these projects building paint facilities for General Motors, building snack food plants for Frito-Lay, and building roasting facilities for Starbucks around the world. I was the guy that said, regulation, there is no cost-effective innovation, and the result is going to be you're going to put our company out of business. These companies, those were our statements that we made. So what happened? Cap on VOC emissions for paint facilities drove the use of water-based paints for the automotive industry that General Motors spearheaded. The result turns out to be that it's more resilient paint, warranty costs went down, they had a return on investment in 2 years. $330 million investment. What about Frito-Lay? PM10 emissions on chip fryers. We had to recover oil from the steam emissions coming out of those fryers. What happened with it? Well, we reclaimed 5% of the oil that was going out of those stacks and put it back into the fryer. We also figured out how to reduce and extend the life of the oil by a process of oxidation that we had to save and retain it. But because of this system, we figured out how to do that. 18 months return on investment. Starbucks, more PM10 emissions. We introduced from another industry, catalytic oxidizers, to reduce the cost at the time of trying to destruct PM10 emissions. So I'm trying to show here that the industry, as regulation comes in, the industry generally, there's innovation for it, and they figure it out. And a lot of times, there's benefits to it. Not all times, but sometimes. I also wanted to give our background in the wine industry. So over the last 17 years, we've done work not on these VOC emissions, but in doing packaging lines and fermentation systems and bottling plants and warehouses for some of the wineries and more well-known wineries. So where are we today? I call it a wine story. In 2009, Santa Barbara enforced daily VOC limits on a couple of the wineries in their district. One of those wineries gave us a call and said, help, is there something that we can do? What came out of that was we worked on research and development from 2009 to 2014 to get to what we call our current standard. That picture off to the side was version 1.0 of the very first machine that we tried to figure out how to do this. And from that machine, we kind of had an aha moment, very similar to the what comes out of the systems. You see this clear liquid. And this is 12% alcohol. And we thought it was going to be tinted red. When we saw it was clear, we went, wow, okay, so that's the capture that's coming out. There's VOC, there's ethanol in it, but it's a usable byproduct, just as we both discovered. There's a usable byproduct, and I'll talk about that more in a little bit. So what's our current status? Current status is we have version 4.0, so it's gone through an evolution. We've had 6 consecutive harvests of these machines running and operating in wineries. I'll show you some pictures of those in a little bit. In 2017, Santa Barbara County saw us as back, going through all the terms and regulations that Patrick had mentioned. We have 3 patents on it, or 1 patent in the United States, 1 in Australia, and 1 that's pending sitting on the examiner's desk in Europe. So here I want to talk about configurations. How do they fit into the winery? How do you use them? Not so much the internal technologies, because that's a bit of the secret sauce for us, is how the guts work. So we have these different configurations. We have a mobile tank for smaller wineries. If you want to take one of our systems and pick it up and move it from area to area to area, hook it up to 1 or 2 tanks, this can actively manage about 60,000 gallons of fermenting wine. It's plug and play. There's no moving parts inside. There's a pump that hooks up to it, and it's a wine pump. So we don't go, there's no specialized things outside of that move or have to replace it with. The next part is on the bigger systems, is when we got into start doing network systems. So you have tank farms, and you've got banks of tanks, maybe 10 or 20 tanks on a certain platform, and you'll have another row of 20 tanks and another row of 20 tanks. Kind of awkward to pick up that system and move it around, have fork trucks going all over the place. So what these systems are, they're assigned to a bank of tanks. And the tanks are either interconnected, which I'll show you in a little bit, or they can be connected as needed. These systems can handle about 100,000 gallons of fermenting wine. So if you have 10, 30,000 gallon tanks, if three of those tanks are in active fermentation, one system can handle that. And as Patrick also mentioned, the CIP, because of what's coming out of here, is for us, we do use water in the process as a base. So you get a slurry effect, so you get an alcohol and water type product. So it's a cleaning system that basically cleans it. And I'll address another cleaning frequently asked question that we get at the end. Then we get into the next big question, and that is on super tanks. What happens when you get into these tanks that are 100,000 gallons, 200,000, 300,000? Well, we have there's a physical limitation to our physics in our device, and the one that I just showed you previous is about as big as you want to get before we start running into trouble. But the problem thing is now we can just go, instead of just having one, well, we put two, three, four, whatever number that you need to handle that volume of gas, and that's really what you're trying to do is manage the volume of CO2. That's the fast-moving stuff that's going through it. And how do you balance that out and not create a back pressure on the tanks and let it run the way that it should be running in a safe and balanced way? This is CO2 management, and we've designed in the past for some wineries a system of interconnecting tanks while they're fermenting to exhaust the CO2 outside of the building. Because as CO2 comes into the building, what they have to do is they have to change the air all the time because CO2 levels build up. It's not safe for people. So that conditioned air is expensive. So a lot of several wineries have said, how do we interconnect our tanks, exhaust it outside, so we're not spending that money? If a facility has that in place, then we just connect our system to that discharge, and we've got it captured. If they don't, then putting in a connected network system allows you now to have a single point of connection and a single point of exhaust. So now we can exhaust those CO2 gases out of the building and saving the facility money and operating costs. So here I say ways to work. What is this stuff? And as I showed you here, it's this clear liquid, 6 to 14% ethanol, and it's clear and it's a water-based solution. What can you do with it? We are not in the wine business, so we've talked to our customers and say, where can we go from here? Right now, the system has been given back status with all of the slurry being sent to waste, not being used for anything else. So the cost of disposing of it is included right now in the back analysis. We think that there's some higher value uses that can happen with this. We think you can blend, you may be able to blend it back to balance the tanks. You can look at using it to create other beverages, wine, vodka, as you guys just experienced. And you can also look at it, if you don't want to make a product of it, you can use it as a pre-cleaning agent. You're using solvent bases all the time to rinse tanks, to rinse pipes, to do those things. So you can use it as a pre-wash system. You can also use it as push water. So when wineries are pumping from one tank to another tank and changing from red wine to white wine, they put a plug of water in there to isolate those two things so they can operate efficiently. You could use this for that. It's ethanol and water connected together from those lines, with no crossover. This isn't red, it's not a white tinge, it's just a clear liquid. The one other thing I was going to add, I mentioned that you've got the ability to take the CO2 from the end of the system and exhaust it out. Go back, here it is. What you have now that we've cleaned up the CO2. So there are systems out there where you can take that CO2 now and convert it into something else. You can capture it, you can turn it into a paste that can be used in gypsum or into concrete. So there's a variety of things outside of just exhausting it that you can start to do. The problem is that if you take that gas without the ethanol out of it, is that it's contaminated and you can't sequester it. So this starts to clean up that airflow process so you can do other things with it, potentially. So some frequently asked questions. Is there impact to the wine? For the going on 10 years, just over 10 years that we've been developing and playing with this, and over the last 6 years of it being in functional operation in wineries, we haven't had any complaints. Nobody has come back to say that has caused my wine to go bad, or I've had flavors in it, or back, or pushback, or anything like that. What happens if a tank has a foam over? In general operations, you don't want foam overs. It's expensive. There's a lot of controls that have been put into wineries, into wine tanks, temperature control to manage foam overs, because you want to keep all the wine in your tank. But if there is, then you have a cleanup procedure. This goes through, it's going to go through the system. But as I mentioned, there's no moving parts in the system. So, and then when you get it going again, it's just alcohol and water, and it cleans itself. Away we go. And cleaning up, I have been involved with a foam over in a tank, and it's a mess anyway. There's a lot of other things that are going on at that. And as I mentioned before, are there any specialized wear parts? The life expectancy that we've seen right now, we've had units in operations for 6 years, and we haven't replaced any parts inside of it. And we expect the life expectancy to be somewhere between 15 minimum up to 20, maybe 25 years. The moving parts come from pumps and things that are already in the facility. So there's nothing new. Here's a pump, it's a wine pump. They have parts, a lot of them fix them and build them. That's it. No, try to blast through as best I could.
No, you did good, Dan. Thank you. Any questions from board members? Okay, so at this point in time, we'll open it up to members of the public that wish to comment on the presentation by staff or the two guest presenters. Is there anybody from the wine industry that would like to comment on this? Thank you. You have about 3 minutes.
Okay, hi, I'm Kim Stemmler. Quick question, Mary, I was confused because I've seen a chart that just says we produce 27% of the VOC and your chart's 50. So let's talk about that later, okay? First of all, thank you, Richard, and thank you everyone for working with us. The Monterey wine community is who I represent. You represent a larger group of wineries. We take care of our community. We take care of our land, we believe we take care of our air, and we take care of our employees. So why is this an issue right now? First of all, what we'd like is to be aligned with the state VOC levels. 25 tons per year, annual, that would be great. I can't read it. Because the local regulations are lower than other winemaking regions, what's happening is our grapes are being shipped out of the community, okay? The same VOC levels are being produced in other communities, so we're not reducing VOCs in the state. We're just moving them. And then we're increasing the carbon footprint because there's mobile emissions. But because you guys only regulate, you don't regulate mobile emissions and you only regulate the VOC emissions here, that doesn't matter. But really, by not having local wineries right next to where grapes grow, we're creating a bigger footprint. So what the wine industry would like, and you can speak to this a little bit more, is to have UC Davis do a study on how to control this and not have any impact on wine quality. And so you may ask, well, these guys have said it doesn't have any impact on wine quality. But you have to remember, this is an industry. We've been making wine for 8,000 years. There are practices in place, and they are evolving. But it's still not clear to winemakers whether cork or screw tops are better, or whether mechanical or hand harvested are better. So you really have to convince these wineries and winemakers and growers with evidence-based research. And Santa Barbara's is not enough to convince them. They want to see something out of UC Davis. So what's the resistance we're hearing from everyone? So besides they don't know about the impact that it ultimately makes, it's also, they say, well, plants produce VOCs. So if we left the grapes on the vine, wouldn't it produce the same VOCs? I don't know that. And also grapevines are carbon sequesters. So aren't grapevines good things? They're around for 30 years. They're sequestering carbon. The other big issue within the county is that both the county and all of the South County cities want the wine industry to develop for the economic impact. And I keep on going. No, sir.
Just finish your thought.
Okay, for the economic impact of South County, really. But right now, we are in no growth region to two very large wineries who were looking for places to put new wineries because of this air emission standard. Yep. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you to Dan and Patrick, your innovation and your contribution to the wine industry is appreciated. And I know that there's a state discussion on this. There is growing pressure on the industry to do a better job to address the VOCs, among other things, as all manufacturing is under the thumb of. As I understand it right now, based on a previous action of this board, we have standing direction to Rich to engage the ARB to change the offset in Rule 207 from a daily to an annual limit. So that's underway. We've acted on that. Alongside ongoing subcommittee discussion, offline discussion with our NGO, today's presentation is more information and very helpful. So I don't know if new direction is needed. It sounds like there's a comment from Rich, but we definitely want to either say something and move on or stick with where we're at. Rich, you had something you were at.
So I do have an update on our conversations with the state. And so I want to preface this remark with the fact that we've had our Rule 207 in the state for 3 years, and they still haven't acted on it. So I've informed them that this is a high priority item for this board, and they need to get off the dime and deal with this. And so it's taken an extra month beyond the deadline they established for themselves to get it back to us, but we just recently heard back to them that they would like us to withdraw our current Rule 207 revision that has been in there for 3 years, amend it to reflect these new limits, which we're happy to increase. But you know, I heard Kim say that basically there, you know, doesn't no regulation, but that's not what we received from the industry. They want to see an increase in the daily emission, or do away with the daily emission, and then increase the annual emission. And we're happy to put that in our rule. And I can say we can't unilaterally do that. We have to go through the public process. And that's a rule change. The state then has to come and do a hearing, and they have to make the findings, or we have to present those findings so it's not going to interfere with the attainment status. And we are happy to do that. That's a heavy lift. We were happy to do that. So I don't want the board to think that there's any resistance here from me or staff in getting that accomplished. We want to work effectively with the wine industry. And the only reason I mentioned that is that these recent developments have, at least in the mind of the state, caused a paradigm shift.
Yeah, there will be plenty more to be continued at the state level, but as for the local, and we're hearing back from the ARB, it sounds like our existing request of their review can be amended to include this.
So what I would like is the board, if you want us to pursue that, a formal action to direct us to revise the rule. I don't know if we did that.
I unfortunately don't have a complete memory of what the actual motion was back in December. However, I would recommend, just for the record to be clear, that there be a motion and a vote directing the APCO and staff to revise the rule as recommended by the state board and send it back in for reconsideration.
Okay, so is there a motion?
So I'm happy to make that motion, and if I can, I'd like to make a couple brief comments as to why I'm doing
that. We'll get back to that. So, okay, good. We have a motion and a second. Thank you. Okay, so we have a motion and a second, and we'll go ahead and any comments?
So just, you know, the comments were, I just heard that it was a balanced article in the weekly, and I didn't agree with that, and I just wanted to state that, because for me, the pointing out that it's a large corporation from somewhere else that's coming here and doing things in our area and not providing us a benefit was a point to me that didn't sit well. You know, doing some back-of-the-envelope costs on the penny per bottle, and I come from a family of salespeople, so I know the number you get is always kind of best case scenario, right? And so even at a penny a bottle for the largest operator, that is $1.5 million. And that, to me, is a significant number. Those are jobs that are going to be at some point offset in that cost. For some of the local companies, you know, that cost is $250,000. Again, in best case scenario. Those are real numbers. And again, when we look at the maps, well, it, December, when we look at the maps of what areas we're eligible to get, grant funding and available to get some of these programs that were available, the red maps were was majority in my district, right?
Yep.
And we don't want grant funding, we want jobs, we want to work for what we get, and that's what these companies are providing in my community. As we looked at where these companies sit, they're 10 of the 11 are in my district, and we want jobs, we want to go to work, and we want to do something that means something every single day. And so, you know, that's the opportunity that my community is asking for, and that's the reason I'm happy to make this motion and push forward.
Great. Thank you, Director Lopez. I think it's clear, you know, again, helpful to have the background and be very knowledgeable on this. Any further comments?
I do have some comments, but I want to understand. So this going back to the state and revising the rule, what does that mean? Is the rule that we submitted the one with the daily limit and all? I just don't understand what base we're on and then what base we're going to. Or from.
We would eliminate the daily and doing the ultimate annual limit.
So our current rule has the daily limit.
So
is that what?
So it gets really complicated. Let me just explain it this way. We had proposed a rule revision to get the state and federal in more of alignment. And so we sent it out for comments. EPA said, good, you're good to go. And we didn't hear anything from the state. So we implemented, the board had blessed it, and we thought it was a rule to use. Then the state came and said, we never approved that. We are going to withdraw your rule. So that's been sitting in limbo for the last 3 years. So we've said now that that's in limbo, we want to additionally change the levels to do away with the daily emission limit and increase from 10 tons to 25 tons of the offset. And they said, and we said, should we just submit a new rule? Should we withdraw the old rule? How should we do that? This is going to be most expeditious. And they said, withdraw your rule, submit a new rule for our consideration. But they already said they have determined it's probably going to be backsliding, and that they would require, if we're proposing those changes, to do a hearing here. So, and I don't have a time schedule, and I'm sorry about that, but I have informed the board that this is very important to this jurisdiction.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact that, I mean, we're trying to do a couple things here, I don't remember if it was part of this presentation or one of the earlier ones, that when we are in non-attainment, that we need to pursue all possible measures. So I'm just a little concerned about backing away from a daily amount of emissions when there are ongoing emissions that are happening. So it just seems like, and I think we have different rules here, apparently not as stringent, or we were proposing rules here that are maybe more stringent than some areas, but not as stringent as Santa Barbara, because we're not in attainment for ozone, and these volatile organic compounds are precursors. So I just think we need to be very attentive to this, and frankly, the conversation locally and statewide and nationally is demanding higher standards, and to not let our water get further polluted, our air get further polluted. So I think we, as an air district, I think we want to be very careful about not adhering to the standards that can improve the quality of our air and not make it worse. So I'm concerned about looking like we're relaxing the standards or backsliding. And I don't think we should be doing that. I think the jobs are important, but if we're creating jobs at the cost of risking people's health, the air pollution that is generated in the valley through the volatile organic compounds and the dust, these cause problems for people. They cause asthma and other respiratory and physical problems. And we don't want to be wishing that on our residents. So I think that we have to be very, very cautious about this. The Salinas Valley is beautiful and produces a lot of important products, but that's no reason that we shouldn't be doing everything we can to reduce the emissions that cause problems. I appreciate the product that is being produced by the wine industry. I think I like that industry better than I like, say, Dynegy, but I appreciate electricity when it comes into my house too. And there are realities here that we have to balance. So I don't agree with going in this direction as much as I appreciate the emotional content and the sway that this has. I also think it's not just about the wine industry. There are other industries in our region that produce these volatile compounds, and I'm concerned that if we start backing off on a rule, we may be trying to do a favor for one group, but it's going to be applied to all industries. And I don't know what the impact of that is, but it's greater than, whether the wine industry is producing 30% or 50% of the volatile organic compounds, where are the rest of them coming from, and what would relaxing this rule do for the other industries and with the resultant impact on our health and our health and our air quality? So I think if we do take this kind of step, we're going to need to do a thorough environmental impact report, some kind of analysis, because there are going to be cumulative impacts of this action that need to be studied. So I'm just really concerned about this, and I would not want this to be a unanimous vote to take this kind of action. Continuing to look at what the options are, okay, but really backing off on something that could bring us closer to attainment. There are technologies that can help the industry work with this kind of thing and be the good stewards of the environment that they are in so many other ways. So, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sure there will be a thorough hearing if and when it ever comes. Sounds like so.
Well, and I'm just concerned too about spending a bunch of taxpayer money on something that is backsliding. If we have to do environmental review, if we have to do all kinds of studies, I just feel like that's not a good use of a public fund.
Understood. Yes, Dr.
I will support the motion. I went to a wine tasting just strictly for the grapes grown in Santa Lucia Highlands, and 85% of the wineries that were there using our grapes were from outside the area. And the idea that I think it ought to be approached, if we're going to have standards, they ought to be statewide standards. But the idea that we're loading on a truck and using the truck and the pollution of the truck to drive up someplace where they don't have the standards that we do is wrong. And it's not right to our industry. It's not right to, it's easy to say, but that's his district, and those are a lot of jobs that are going unwanted. So.
Thank you. I know we asked a couple times for comments from the public. Is there anybody else? Okay, so seeing that, we'll go ahead and call for a vote. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign?
No.
Okay, motion carries. Okay, first roll call.
Yes.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming out. We're going to go into closed session. We have one item, and we'll be back if there's a portable action. Thank you.
Somebody like Shire.